What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Okay, Christy Penley's here. Ben Sternke's here. Gravity Leadership Podcast. Everybody. I'm Matt Tebbe. What, you got braces, yep. Christy Penley?
I do. Yes, look at it. I look like I'm. Oh yeah. I'm like 13 on the bottom half of my face.
Yeah. Just on the
and
bottom
you guys,
half. Just
I'm
on the like just four just teeth
the
there. What is that?
Just no. The, it's all on the whole bottom.
The
and
whole
it
bottom.
Hurts.
You got braces. Yeah, braces. I remember. I mean, I had them when I was 13.
Yeah, exactly. I feel 13 right now. I don't think Paul's kissed me since I got them on.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like, what is going on with my wife?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel bad because I was like that mean mom who, like, my kids would get their braces tightened. And I'm like, you're fine. You can eat chicken and whatever the things are. And I'm like, I just need yogurt, people.
Yeah.
All right.
Can you blend all my food up? Is it what? Yeah. Anyway, just to straighten up your teeth?
Just, no, it's a weird deal. My bottom teeth were hitting my top two teeth. It's a weird thing. They were shifting and moving, and my dentist was like, "Your top tooth is loose," and he was like, "You're gonna have to get a veneer." And I'm like, "Is there any other option?" And he's like, "Let's try to fix the bottom so that it doesn't touch the top." And okay, here we go.
Wow.
Teeth.
Anyway, that's not what our listeners wanted to hear. I'm sure.
No. Here's what they
sprung that on us.
Here's what they want to hear, though. Yeah. We are going to do a quick quiz, okay? Before we get to this episode, I've known Christy Penley for 20 years, and I've known Ben for 15. And you guys met each other, I think, through our mutual friendships, right?
I think so.
Sort of the matchmaker here. So this quiz is, how well do you know each other?
Oh,
okay.
Boy.
And we're going to keep score.
Christy and I are playing.
Yes.
You're keeping score.
Oh, I'm keeping
and you're the
score.
Host?
I'm the host. Welcome
you're the host.
To Keeping Score.
How well do you know each other with Christy and Ben?
Yep. All right. Here we go. Ready?
Right. Ready.
You get, I want you get an extra point if you answer first. Okay.
Oh,
so I want you to say your name. If you want to answer, that's your buzzer. Okay,
that's how we buzz in.
You buzz in by saying your name,
my name, Christy. Not Christy's name.
You say Christy, and Ben, you say Ben or Benjamin, and then you give the answer, and you can only answer one time. All right.
Okay. Okay.
And this is a question I'm asking. These are questions you're answering about the other person. So,
okay.
Where, what hometown were you born in?
I feel nervous.
Ben, I'm buzzing in.
Okay.
Where I was born?
What hometown was Christy born in, Ben?
Grand Rapids.
Wrong.
I don't know.
No.
I just went with my gut on that.
It was close. Okay,
Christy. Mm-hmm. I don't know this. I know.
It feels weird to say your name, doesn't it? Christy.
I don't know.
Hey, I'm talking.
I think my name is Ben. Minnesota. But I don't
know. That's not
the
city. A town.
It is. Yeah. It is Minnesota.
It's Rajahara, Minnesota.
Oh, that was really close.
I could have just.
That was really close.
Christy, I could have just said, Michigan then. So all right. I actually
you
tried
could
the
have,
town.
But you yeah. didn't. So I think I get a half a point.
0 points. Well,
I think
for
I
each,
get a half a point.
0 points
though.
For each of you. How many half pets does the other person have? And
Christy. Oh.
And bonus points if you name the pets' names.
The pets' names.
Christy.
Okay.
One.
And you give a name?
It's like an old lady name.
I think that's worth half a point. It's very true.
I think it's, I'm going to guess Ethel.
Oh, so close.
That's so close.
It's Edith.
What
so
is
close.
It? Oh, man.
Okay, so Christy.
I think it's worth half a point for sure.
I think it's worth half a point.
You buzzed in Ethel's early. You answered first, so you get 2 points for that right answer. Ben, do you want to take a stab at either number or names?
He does not know the right answer.
I don't think I do.
All right.
I'm going to say two pets.
Two family pets. I'm going to say that that's
pets.
Correct.
Oh, okay, yay, two family Ben, pets. Good job.
My daughter has a nice. Hamster, but I don't count that.
Oh, okay.
And then sometimes there's
for some reason I thought you had two.
Three dozen chickens, but not yet, right?
Yeah, that's true. Not right now. Okay. It's not Easter yet.
All right.
Okay.
Do you know the names of my pets?
Oh, I can't remember the name of your dog. I think I'm just going to go with Tucker.
No. Story.
Story. That's great.
Yeah, she's a cutie. I don't know, all right. Favorite music style?
Oh, gosh. Chrissy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Rock.
I mean, that's historically probably the right answer. I like lots of different kinds of music, but I have a soft spot in my heart for rock music. The coolest show I went to last year was Jack White.
Yeah.
Just melted my face off.
He's rock.
Yes. Yeah. That's right? Just straight up rock music. Jack White. I would say, Christy, your favorite kind of music is Bette Midler. Just all the songs by Bette Midler.
You nailed it. Good job, Ben.
All right.
It's a whole genre, Bette Midler.
All right. We're gonna keep moving. All right. Favorite kind of exercise?
Ben, I'm buzzing in. Christy's favorite kind of exercise is hiking.
Huh. This is a hard, I don't even know how to answer that. That's not what I do every day as my exercise. Yeah. I do Camp Gladiator.
But it's your favorite.
Camp Gladiator? What is that?
What is that? What is that?
Oh, yeah. You know, these guns right here that are growing
I see those pipes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like an online thing. You pay and it's great. Okay. But I would, I don't think, I like to hike, but that's not my favorite.
Okay. Ben.
But I think Ben likes to go to the gym.
I do like to go to the gym. Okay. It's what I do.
That's what you do.
Is that your favorite exercise?
It's his favorite.
I guess so. Yeah.
All right. We're four questions in. We have three questions left. Right now, the score is Ben has 1 point and Christy has 5 points.
Christy.
All right.
It's okay, Ben. You can catch up.
All right, Ben. Here's a little help for you. Has the other person ever had braces?
Yes, buzzing in. Christy has. She's had braces.
2 points for Ben.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Christy, do you want to answer?
Let me see your teeth, Ben. I'm going to say yes.
Yes.
All right. Christy gets it.
You're right. Okay. I actually gave it away earlier in the episode.
Yeah, you did.
I just was making sure everybody's listening. That's good. All right, two more questions. How long has the other person been married? You have to get with Christy. You have to get within 2 years.
That was Edith.
There's Edith.
Okay. I'm going to say 25 years for Ben.
You're really close. It's 26. Yay! 26 years.
Okay.
Okay.
27 this summer. I'm going to say for Christy, I'm going to say 19 years.
Yes, 19 years. It's going to be 20 years in like a couple months.
Really? I was right?
Yes.
19? You were. I know.
Yes.
That's great.
All right. Final question.
Why is that funny?
Final question. How many kids?
Wait. What's the score? Is this actually a game?
He's keeping score.
I'm keeping score, Christy. I'll let you know here at the end.
He's fudging the numbers a little bit for me.
How many kids does the other person have?
I'm buzzing in with Christy. Six.
Oh,
six.
Four.
Hang on a second.
But you didn't say
Christy
your name.
Christy said her name.
Ben. Sorry. Ben's like, so weird buzzing in with my name. I'm much better with an onomatopoeia, kind of like a buzz.
I have to go with Christy first. Christy, how many kids?
Okay.
Four.
Correct. Right.
Ben, what do you think for Christy?
I was going to say six.
It does change, but I don't
know.
I'm going to say six because there's one of your kids that I'm not sure his official status, but
this is true. Yes, we have six kids.
But
you're
six
right.
kids are living in the house.
That's right.
You treat them as kids. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'm happy to report that you both know each other fairly well. This is good.
All right.
Christy, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 points. Christy got 10 points, only didn't know where Ben was born, although you said Michigan or Minnesota, and it was Rochester. Yeah. Like you were so close. It was like you're trying to say Rochester with your mouth marbles in your mouth.
It's not
Rochester.
That's something that you actually. Yeah, I was not born in Rochester, nor have I ever lived in Rochester. But my family now lives in Rochester.
Okay,
so I was born in Minneapolis and lived most of my life in a little town called Fairmont.
Fairmont. Maybe I should get to know you, Ben. Give me just a moment to count up all your points. It's going to take a bit.
Yeah,
1, 2, 3.
Get out your abacus.
4, 5. 5 points. So, Christy, you got twice as many points as Ben.
Hey, good game, Ben.
Good game, everybody.
Good game. Yeah. Yep. Get you next year.
We'll ask the same questions next year.
I'm gonna study up.
And hopefully I won't have braces then.
All right. Well, today we've got Sean McCain-Tirez and Melissa Flohr-Bixler on the podcast. There were so many areas we didn't get to, Ben. I was reflecting about this with both Melissa and Sean after this podcast about there were just other avenues we wanted to explore. But I thought it was a lively discussion.
It was great. Yeah. I really appreciate both of them. And their thoughts about this is like this issue of like thinking about the instinct that we have, you know, for Christian centrism and what that instinct is moving us towards, but then what it ends up doing. Like I've been thinking about this for a long time and trying to be able to articulate what's going on when people articulate things like this. So anyway, they were really helpful in terms of bringing some clarity to why the instinct for centrism doesn't actually work for us as Christians. It actually doesn't. It ends up serving the status quo.
Yeah.
And they were really helpful in helping us understand
why that
is. It
doesn't do the work we want it to, and it does unhelpful work that we don't intend.
Right. Yeah. Which it's like such a tricky issue to talk about because of those dynamics.
Mm-hmm. So, well, anyway. Christy wasn't able to be on this podcast, but she gets
I'm looking forward to listening
along with the rest of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, here we go.
We're joined today by Melissa Flohr-Bixler and the Reverend Dr. Sean McCain-Tirez today on the Gravity
Leadership Podcast. Melissa is the pastor of Raleigh Mennonite Church and a graduate of Duke University and Princeton Theological Seminary. Much of her formation has taken place in the LARCH community of Portland, Oregon, and she now is the chair of LARCH North Carolina and a steering committee member in a broad-based organizing in her county there. Melissa's writing has appeared in various publications such as Christian Century, Sojourners, Anabaptist Witness, Faith in Leadership, and she's the author of Fire by Night, Finding God in the Pages of the Old Testament, and How to Have an Enemy, Righteous Anger and the Work of Peace, which we chatted about together a while ago on this podcast. Reverend Dr. Sean McCain Tirez is the founding rector of Resurrection Anglican Church in South Austin, Texas. And before that, he helped plant Redeemer Anglican Church in Santa Cruz, California. His doctoral work focused on a practical sacramental missiology. That's a mouthful, Sean. And he currently serves on the Revelation 7-9 Task Force for Justice and Inclusion in the Diocese of the Churches for the Sake of Others. Sean and Melissa, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's good to be here with y'all too.
Thanks. So we wanted to have a conversation today on this, I think, increasingly prevalent emerging political position that I hear articulated in Christian spaces, known as sort of a third way political engagement or a centristic political engagement. And then sometimes it's labeled, and we'll talk about this, a fourth way. You know, so it's neither left nor right nor center, but fourth way. And I want to maybe read the way this sounds. But before I do that, I want to name maybe my own sort of experience with this real quick by way of context and setting up this conversation. For a majority of my Christian life, I saw myself as apolitical, meaning I didn't vote in elections. I thought that elections were sort of below me or beneath me as a Christian. The first time I remember voting in an election was in 2008 for John McCain. I voted for John McCain because I was living in Chicago and I knew Obama would win. And this is what I told myself. This is what, 15 years ago? If I don't vote for John McCain, Barack Obama will think he's got a blank check to do whatever he wants. And I want him to know that at least somebody in Chicago didn't vote for him. So he has to, quote, play nicely, right? And I think that was my beginning of, I need to temper the abuses or the extremes of both sides. And I kind of lived there for the next 5 to 10 years. I think 2016, that began to fall apart for me. But for the next 8 years or so, that was kind of where I found myself comfortably. And I want to hear from all y'all, maybe your experience with this. You know, if you want to tear that, what I just said apart, feel free. That's why we do this podcast, so we can be humbled. But let me just say how this sounds, just to set it up. It sounds like this. It sounds like, and I'm pulling this from an article by Adam Joyce on Christian centrism, and we'll put this in the show notes. But here's some of the way that centrism sounds. The far right and far left are two sides of the same coin. They're both fundamentalists, extremists with different divisive orthodoxies. Sometimes it sounds like this. I'm pro-life from womb to tomb. So the right is mad at me sometimes and the left is mad at me other times, which means I must be doing something right. Basically, I'm not progressive or conservative. I'm a Christian and Christ is my king. All right, one more because we just got to get it. That's the third way. We've got to get the fourth way here. The church, here's a quote, the church is not to be found at the center of a left-right political world. The church is to be a species of its own kind, confounding right and left and so-called middle and finding its ID from the center of God's life. All right, so that's a long preamble here. Melissa, I'm going to throw it to you. When did you first encounter this idea of centrism? And when you encountered it, was it appealing to you or not?
Yeah, I have an interesting relationship to this because I grew up in the Episcopal Church, which considers itself a kind of third way between, you know, kind of some forms of Protestantism and then Catholicism. And then I eventually, as an adult, joined the Mennonite Church, which also considers itself a third way. So I have this this pretty deep sort of experience of people trying to look for, like, identify two sides and then try to negotiate or try to figure out something else. But I think in a very different way from your experience of centrism, what I understood what it meant to be a Mennonite, when we say we're neither Catholic nor Protestant, it didn't mean that you were somewhere in the middle. It meant that both Catholics and Protestants are trying to kill you. That's the root of the tradition. And so this is, and this kind of came in at the same time that I was a student of Stanley Hauerwas. And I think Stanley has been misconstrued over the years, he's been sort of co-opted into this sort of, like, the church is somehow floating above the chaos of this world. But I think if you actually are true to Hauerwas's work, he would say that, you know, there is actually some mapping, political mapping in our world of this sort of sense of living into the heart of Jesus. And that is called socialism, right? Like, it's not as if there isn't, there are secular parables out there, to quote Barth, that offer us some way of connecting our ecclesial lives to the things that are happening in the world. The question is just about, you know, how do you make those decisions, right? What are the costs? And Mennonites know this very well, right? Because we've made very costly decisions not to participate in particular forms of life that animate the sect of the empire, right? So when I hear centrism, it feels very, parts of it feel very strange to me, because this is really where I cut my theological teeth, was in that sort of place between joining the Mennonite Church and being a student of Stanley's.
Sean, how about you? These quotes I read, how have you encountered, or have you encountered this? Did you have a time when it appealed to you? And and do you think this is the reason it appeals to most people, or was it a unique reason, maybe like Melissa shared?
I think I've experienced it in a few ways, especially growing up in a military family, from Texas, no less, and having a Mexican mom and a white West Texan dad, there's sort of a lot, I think, built into my experience that I didn't really recognize, couldn't really recognize as between a lot of things. Like, people ask you, where are you from? And I'm like, I don't know where I'm from. I'm not from somewhere. And so centrism, it sort of plays along a similar line that appealed to me in certain areas of my life, that helped me avoid conflict, helped me having to sort of pick a side, but also resonated with my own story that could be without place and not really, like, piss anybody off. You know what I mean? And sort of keep the peace in false ways, actually. Or even to come in, it was always appealing to me in a more intellectual level, because it always had a centrism, always had an air of, like, superiority to it. Like,
yes,
you guys are fighting about these things, let me just say something here and that'll clear everything up. So it had that kind of appeal as well. And so throughout my life, I think I've always bumped into it, and it's always been alluring and tempting in its own ways.
Yeah. That's similar for me. I think it was appealing because you sort of immediately see the drawbacks, or the ways that the American political binary sort of, you know what I mean, like, doesn't work. And it felt appealing to me to say, oh, there's a third way. There's a different way to be Christian. And as on the idea level, it's true. You know what I mean? Like, sure, faith can't be reduced, you know, to these binaries.
And now a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us.
It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
I'm curious for the two of you, when did you begin to, both of you have sort of stories of sort of coming from this in different ways, coming from this kind of idea, but when did you start to see the problems with centrism or third way kind of politics or faith? Are there relationships, are there situations where these things made themselves known to you? Like, are there sort of liminal moments where this happened? Anything for you? Maybe go back to you, Melissa.
Yeah, you know, I think this is always, I've always felt the tension around this. And because even within the Mennonite church, as with a lot of churches, you know, there's people have different ideas about things and want to get along. And this, the same sort of longing, Ben, that you heard, I hear in my tradition as well. And so this happens all the time, right? We have conflict about things, and we have to decide how we're going to resolve conflict. Right? That's sort of the basis of all of this. I think about one, this wasn't sort of the first thing I noticed, but this is just one example. When I got to the church that I serve now, Raleigh Mennonite, I would say that we had a kind of soft exclusion of LGBTQ people in our church, in the sense that the people, they had actually gone through as a church this multi-year process of trying to ask this question that was brought to them by someone in the neighborhood. What can LGBTQ folks do and not do in your church, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, we should talk about this. So they spend years having this conversation. And they really make an effort that they're going to clear this up before the new pastor gets there. They do. I come in and I ask people about the decision. And a lot of people have different ideas about how that decision turned out. It turns out there was really this sense of, well, if we don't really take a stand on this, if we're not clear about it, we can sort of keep open the possibilities for people who have different ideas about LGBTQ folks to continue to worship in the space together and be together, which is great unless you actually have LGBTQ people in your church who actually want their marriages and their children supported and actually want people to be a part of helping their relationships thrive. And they don't want certain people to opt out of their lives. And so we had to clarify. The first 6 months there were spent saying, what do we actually mean when we say we're an affirming church? But I think this happens in all sorts of ways at churches. This is certainly something I think that happens a lot nowadays in the church.
Yeah. So I hear you saying in that example that one of the ways that you see this breaking down is when it goes from the level of an idea that seems good, like, oh, we'd love for people with different ideas to be able to, you know, worship together. But you begin to see that it breaks down when all of a sudden the embodied nature of having somebody, it's one thing to have an idea about somebody. It's another thing to sit next to them in church, you know, or to take communion with them or to have them apply to be part of the children's ministry. It's like, okay, well, this vague idea doesn't work anymore, does it? You know, like, yeah, now we have to make some, yeah.
Right. These are all materialist realities, yeah. Right? They all actually touch down eventually in somebody's lives.
Yes.
And if you're dealing with material realities, you have to talk about power, right? And I think that is this very scary word that is actually, I would pinpoint as the, like this, the center of centrism's problem is a power issue. In a lack of desire to do a power analysis, because that feels very secular. But of course, Jesus is doing this all the time, right? You know, which one of us will sit at your left and your right, or, you know, who will be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, right? Jesus is, talks about power all the time, but we're very anxious about it.
Yeah. I definitely want to return to that, that idea, that I think that does get to the heart of it for sure. But how about you, Sean, any like particular instance for you where you started to realize, hey, this isn't really working the way I thought it was supposed to?
The ideas that come to mind, the memories that come to mind about this have to do often with the church. And Melissa, I really appreciate your point about the part that centrism is, has to do with power. We have to reckon with power, and we don't want to because it's, feel secular, but I'd also say oftentimes because it, those who can hold the center space, that centrist space, don't need to analyze power, benefit from the way that it's just like, well, we don't need to, you know. And so I think it's helpful to clarify, especially I'm thinking of in Texas, the sort of gun laws that are unbelievable, like ridiculous. And how we've even had people carry like open carrying weapons in the church coming forward for Holy Eucharist or saying, hey, do you want me to bring my gun to keep the church safe? And I say, absolutely not. So like, and imagining like, and it, this is like very, very common in Texas. People think you see people wearing guns all the time. You really don't. They hide them. But the reality is there. And to hold a centrist position there, I think really you clearly see, and we've been in this, I've been in this predicament, you clearly see like, oh, this is not good to hold a centrist. Like, well, you know, some people are into weapons and others aren't, but let's just manage the middle here. It doesn't actually work because you end up still with weapons in the room, right? You still end up with the dynamic of power that now weaponized literally and a whole bunch of people who aren't. And not only that, but it is transgressing, I think, very deeply a value of the people gathered around the crucified God, that to be centrist in a arrangement like about weaponry or guns like that, I think is to offend, is to actually be misaligned with the reality of the crucified God that is gathering you there. So it becomes, I think, incoherent. It doesn't actually even hold up. To hold a centrist space. So I'm just giving like, there's weapons. I could talk about politics. Almost every sort of, in the last 3 years, every wave of controversy, January 6th, the Black Lives Matter movement and protests, within every one of those headlines, there's those centrists trying to say, well, hold on a second, everybody calm down. And then you're left in a predicament as a pastor of a church, saying do you harbor centrism or do you say something? Do you have something to say, or are you here as a sort of chaplain to the culture wars to try to keep everybody calm? I've certainly felt that as a priest in the last few years in my own body, in my own life, I've felt that.
Yeah. So I hear in this testimony both of you not trying to collapse the unique things you share, but both of you saying that there, you have to discern how power, what, who has power, how it's being used, and is that work unto the kingdom or not, in order to discern, you know, is centrism a faithful position or not. One of the things I'd like to spend time doing, though, and I don't want this to be pedantic, I don't want it to be strained, so if you want to say pass, you can pass, but there's an impulse here. I think there's an impulse here that I want to affirm, which is to allow the political binary of the U.S. to contain the kingdom only exists on the right or only exists on the left. There's something wise about saying, no, that's, we can't allow the kingdom politic to be co-opted by the political binary of the U.S. system. And the reason I want to say this is because I think a lot of the third way centrist people I come into contact with grew up in a religious right, moral majority, culture war household, and they have, I mean, I don't want to be too exaggerated about this, but they have sort of this religious PTSD with that. Like, they have this reactivity to a staunch partisan no, we have 6 months to work out our position on affirming position. And I'm not going to like go on as a pastor until we do this. They have like this reactivity to like drawing those lines because of how it was drawn for them as kids, you know, and the work they saw the culture war do. And so I'm sympathetic to that as well. People not wanting, people having the only way they experience of like holding a line or standing up was in a toxic or abusive way. And so now they're retreating to centrism as away from harm, away from what they've experienced as injury. So you don't have to agree with that sympathetic telling of the narrative. I guess I just throw that out to say, what do you want to affirm about how the kingdom politic isn't beholden to the political binary? Do you have thoughts on that? Is that something you would advocate for, or would you push back on that?
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely true, right? I mean, yes, Jesus is not a Democrat or a Republican. That is, this feels like a very, like, I think in some ways, I think just I've been in the Mennonite church for most of my life now. It feels a little strange to even have to say that out loud. But if that's important, if that's helpful to say that, that's great. I think the question is then, so what? We've done this descriptive work of that this is true, that there are and this also comes from someone who is fairly sectarian. We don't say the Pledge of Allegiance in our house or as part of our church. We don't take oaths, right? Like we don't join the military. And so I do think that I have this impulse within me or that certainly empathizes with that position. And yet has never transitioned into, well, that means that what we have is Eucharist or Sunday morning worship where we, and that's sort of the end of the story. I don't know. Sean, do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think that statement is true, but I often hear it from people, and it functions in spaces that allow for a sort of suspended middle that just like, that allows people to, it's sort of like, we don't have to commit. So we don't have to really get our hands dirty here. We can just wait it out. And that kind of, hey, be patient, that waiting thing is again, a sort of exercise of privilege for those for whom this decision does not impact immediately. Mm-hmm. Those who afford to wait, those who can afford to be in a suspended middle. I hear that from them. So I think, Melissa, you're right. Like, so what the question, it's true. The question then becomes, so then what do we do? What do we think then about this policy? Let's get concrete about these particular things.
Yes.
And I think that people, the next step is really interesting, because then when you start to recognize certain policies that more resemble the kingdom than the other side, then you get this reaction from people like, well, I thought we weren't going to pick up that political platform. I thought we were neither platform. And so the concrete, what do we do next? Started to identify those things. There's like an anxiety of people that comes out like, oh my gosh, we're starting to become a political party now. Mm-hmm. We're aligning ourselves with Democrats or Republicans. We said we wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But that's where the work is. We have to keep pressing into those particular things. And I think I feel convicted to say resisting those sort of true, theologically true statements that function as like stalling or a delay to prevent us from descending into those particular decisions, mm-hmm. that tournament work, you know?
Yeah.
Can I, yeah. So that comment, then maybe we can pivot into this conversation about power. Because what I'm thinking of, Sean, as you say that, is this quote, famous quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, where he says, "I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride towards freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice." And so I wonder if we can pivot then to this impulse that you've named Sean, that like the centrist position assumes the status quo is good. Things are good. We're cool, right? Or this position of, I don't really want to get involved in, you know, getting really brass tacks on how we are a congregation made up of LGBTQ people. Let's just keep it nice, loosey-goosey, so nobody gets offended. Nobody gets hurt, right? This kind of white moderate impulse. Let's talk more about like how do we discern power and know like what to stand up for, what's worth throwing down for, and what we can bear difference in. What are some of the ways we can tell what's worth taking a position on? And then where do we hold things generously with people?
I can jump in. One of the things, this has been a very difficult question for me to figure out, because it feels like sometimes I do need some time to think when these questions come my way as a priest. And one of the, maybe a rule of thumb, or maybe it's just a really well-worn path, studying how Jesus, like how he would deal with arrangements of power, was to always consider this sort of asymmetrical side of power. Like, who is this stepping on? And whether or not I agree with them or not, if someone is on the underside of a violent power or an oppressive power or a burdensome power, I should probably, my hunch is to identify in that space, to go to that space and assume solidarity there before assuming solidarity with the other side of power. So side of being able to see the direction of power, my assumption is to go low, right? It's, if that makes sense, to go to the people who are being most directly pinched or burdened or oppressed by this thing. And then from that place, actually, to ask some questions and to look around and listen. Because oftentimes when I'm not there, I can't understand what's going on until I put my body in contact with or in proximity with these people and say, hey, help me understand. So like, I think the temptation for me, for my type, as would be to sort of step back and get a big context picture, weigh all the facts and sort of come to a conclusion, which sounds nice, but it doesn't put you in proximity of the people who are hurting. And that is, I think, where the most revelatory insights in my life have occurred. And that's where we find Jesus oftentimes. I don't know why it's taking me so long to figure that out, but I think that's who he is. I think that's what he does.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think about that question and, you know, I think I tend to resist having sort of a formula for answering this question, right? Because I think we are there's an instability about these questions that is actually built into our identity as Christians, right? Like we, you know, I think about how at the Jerusalem Council, they decide they're going to not circumcise Gentiles, right? And it's like, oh my gosh, this is a new question, right? There's always going to be a new question before us. They're like, okay, we should talk about this. And like someone who knows lots of things about this, Paul's going to talk to us about it. And then they use this phrase that is very central to our decision-making process at RMC. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us, right? That's how they decide. They talk about it for a while. And then they listen for the Holy Spirit among them. So I tend to think more about what is the kind of community that we can form that is close enough to the gospel to be able to hear the challenge of new questions and to greet them with joy and care, and to draw them constantly in to this body that we are always becoming, right? So process really matters to me. In church, we decide by consensus in our congregation. We have times every Sunday where we listen for the Holy Spirit speaking in our church about what was preached that Sunday as a corporate act of interpretation. So all of that actually feels like it lays the groundwork for us to be able to say, oh gosh, is this something where we can kind of hang together on this, or do we really need to like figure out some solidarities and move forward? And also recognize sometimes we get that wrong and we have to repair, do the repair work afterwards, to get right again with our community and with one another. But I greet that instability. The vulnerability of that identity as a gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Melissa, I appreciate you sharing that because I think that's one of the reasons that we tend to resist this, is it is uncomfortable to live in that tension of not really knowing if I'm doing the right thing at this point. You know what I mean? Like or being confronted with a question that I wasn't confronted with yesterday. You know, it's like, oh gosh, this marginalized person told me that they had difficulty in our worship service for these reasons. And I've never thought about that before. And it's hard to walk through thinking about that. And it's hard to answer some of these questions, I think. And so the importance of having that community of embodied solidarities, these relationships that we have together, to provide a context for which to walk through these discernments. I think that's part of how we can create a power dynamic that doesn't just rely on, you know, the person making the decisions being wise enough to make good decisions, you know, that there's a trust that the Holy Spirit is at work in the midst of not just us having the right ideas about this, but in the midst of our relationships, in the midst of our solidarities, and in the midst of our conflicts, you know, and working those things out. So I appreciate that. It's really helpful.
We'll be right back.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Let's get back to the show. Maybe to wrap us up, we can I can introduce something that is sure to please everybody listening, and that is talking about the pro-life movement. Because I was waiting
for when we were going to get to that. That's great.
Yeah. No, I think this is a really good test case for this, because the people I know who are most attracted to centrism are not comfortable with the weaponization of pro-life on the political right, but also feel like they can't be, you know, let's say a Democrat, or they can't vote Democratic because of the abortion issue. And the reason why this gets tricky, at least in my mind, and Sean, Melissa, you can help me out here, is because a lot of the things we're talking about, power, discerning power, seem to be going on in the typical articulation of how pro-life is framed, right? See, these powerless people, and you're protecting them, right? We're speaking for the voiceless, those kinds of things. And who's more powerless than somebody who's, you know, not even born yet? And so it seems on the surface that the language we're talking about and the language that the pro-life movement are using are commiserate, right? Mm. That they get along together. But I have my own thoughts about why there's a tension there and why that's not quite true. But maybe as a test case, how is what we're describing, how would we apply it to thinking about things like the unborn? Or somebody just sent me a article about MEID in Canada about end-of-life issues and assisted suicide. So how do we think about beginning of life and end of life issues with this lens that we're discussing here, this Jesus-focused, community-discerning, power-discerning lens?
I'll go first on that one, Melissa. I'll pass that along to you.
I do think that there is sort of, as you were saying, this deeply paternalizing sort of idea of even, like, I think the categorization of the unborn, right, is this, right, we're already starting with this assumption of like little tiny 3-week-old people living inside a woman's womb, right? And so I just recognize that even the language that structures this conversation begins with an assumption about, oh, we're working on behalf of people who can't speak for themselves, which of course is always was always complicated in terms of power, that nothing about us without us is just a really important call of disability organizing.
Unpack that for people who are unfamiliar, if you would.
Yeah.
That phrase, what is it get trying to do?
Yeah, so nothing about us without us it really came out of the South African disabilities movement. And the idea was that oppressed peoples, it's great to have solidarities and to have coalition building, but acting as if people without disabilities, able-bodied people, can lead a movement on behalf of these poor, oppressed people who can't speak for themselves, actually negated the whole sort of the dignity and respect that was part, like, intrinsic in this movement. And so I think, like, even here we begin to see, right, that there's this, we're, you know, we're acting on behalf of these, of this oppressed group of people, assumptions, right, about needing to really tie down where life begins and this really liminal space that is actually medically and ethically and morally very complicated and always has been. And then we live in a country where laws are made, right, about things that are complicated by things like pluralism. Right now, there are several Jewish organizations that are suing the Justice Department over these decisions because Judaism allows abortion. And so to violate the rights of Jewish women by outlawing abortion on the basis of Christian principles is a violation, right? This is the world we live
in. Sometimes it's on the basis of Judeo-Christian principles. Like, that's the language that's even used.
Yeah.
which would be then a would be a misnomer for these Jewish organizations.
That doesn't actually exist. That Judeo-Christian is like is not even a real thing, right? So we live within this complication, right, of a pluralistic society, this liminal space between about when life begins, and then the complications about where people's ethical and moral judgments fit into these pictures, right? And all of that is part of negotiations. And honestly, churches feel like they should be really equipped to have those deep conversations, because we're committed to each other, right? We've chosen this life together, and we've chosen to really stick it out through these hard conversations, and to figure out what the stakes are at this particular moment. So I'm really hopeful that churches can be places to have those brave conversations and to move out of sort of a centrism and without having to sacrifice the incredible complexity of all of these issues. There is no issue that is not complex. They're all complex, right? Centrism doesn't mean we don't have to conflate centrism with a really complicated and morally difficult and obtuse set of circumstances, right? Those can be different things.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Melissa. I think I tried to name it as charitably as I could with the frame being used. And what I hear you saying is there's perhaps better frames and better ways into this conversation that allow us to be more faithful. And conflating centrism with a morally complex issue is perhaps not the most helpful way to do it. Yeah. Sean, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I don't have much more to add because I'm just sort of listening and learning here. But another feature of centrism in this space is it often plays out sort of disembodied, as if we can talk about categorically those people and this issue without really humanizing again and finding the reality is there are people in our communities who have experienced abortions or have chosen them or will choose them. And so centrist, I think the temptation there is to deal with it as an issue rather and not to emphasize and appreciate enough the humanity of what's involved here and the people in your care in the room. And so as a centrist, the temptation would be to sort of, again, always be a few inches off the ground, you know, never having to get into the complexity of a person's life and what they're dealing with. And I think that if the church can recognize that, it doesn't make it any easier, certainly makes it harder actually. But I think that's where the real meaningful work of discernment can be done. And not just sort of standing off and pontificating, you know, objectively and trying to sort of locate yourself between sides of an issue, but really, again, being with people, discerning and listening.
Yeah.
And then saying, God, help us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Ben, you have thoughts about this before we close? You're going to tie it up in a neat bow?
I don't know about that. I mean, I do have thoughts about it. I think what I'm hearing, I'm just learning a lot listening to the two of you. So I appreciate you spending some time with us, Melissa and Sean. But what I'm hearing in some of what you're saying is that the centrism that is a problem is a centrism that denies, it sort of tries to float above the issue and not actually wrestle with the issue. So there is an admission of the complexity of the issue that actually demands that we get into the particularities. Okay, what does it mean to be a person? You know, what do we know about this scientifically? Like, you have to talk about that, you know? And so I think, again, Matt, what you mentioned at the beginning is there's a simplicity that, you know, so say you're going to say pro-life versus pro-choice. And on both of those sides, this is the view that people have. On both sides of that issue are people who think the issue is simple. And they're just arguing about what we should care more about. and I think the impulse to centrism ends up becoming just allergic to that conflict and seeing the ways that it doesn't work actually to resolve anything or bring justice or help anybody. But instead of then, I don't know, this is the image I have in my head, instead of descending into the particulars and saying, okay, this is more complex than we thought, we need to hash this out, they try to ascend above it and basically say, we're not going to talk about it. You know, like, let's just worship Jesus and it'll work itself out. Mm. And I think that's the mistake of centrism. It is a fleeing from the conflict because you've seen it done badly that that doesn't serve. You know, it doesn't serve the people who are being harmed. It doesn't serve us, you know, as communities. It doesn't serve us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good, Ben. I'll just add to append here is that I think part of my desire to find a better political expression than what I experience as a third way kind of Christian was the unwillingness and inability to deal with kind of the history that made being pro-life concomitant with being a Christian. And how that historically developed out of a white supremacist patriarchal reaction to, you know, the 1960s and 70s. And I really wanted to deal with that. I'm like, hey, if we're going to have a you know, a Christian ethic of life, then let's decolonize ourselves from this quagmire of power plays, you know? I don't know. Nobody was really interested in that. Like, to suggest that was to signal to the people that I was a threat to really what was created in order to build power. And so it does come back to how power works and what it's doing and being willing to see it. I thank you, Melissa and Sean, for being with us today, helping us, interact with a topic that is hard to talk about, but you both did it with grace and eloquence. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Let's maybe end with just what are you working on right now? What interests you? What are you thinking about writing on these days? Melissa, let's start with you.
I am a part of this big project for Mennonite Church USA that's producing an Anabaptist study Bible is part of the 500th anniversary of the birth of Anabaptism, which is next year. And so I am in charge of several pieces of that. And that's my life right now. It's working on that thing.
Oh, yeah. You know, we didn't.
Sounds like a big project.
It is a big project. We didn't return to this, but how asinine would it be for a Mennonite to say, you know, we're neither this group of people that wants to kill us, nor this group of people that wants to kill us. We're something in between the two people that want to kill us. Like, how asinine would that be, right?
At the end of the day, we're still dead.
Exactly.
Which does then, I think, allow space for a different political imagination to emerge, because there's no illusion that the left or the right or that side or this side has a little bit of good. You know, we just need to sprinkle in a little bit of that good. Sean, what are you working on these days?
My sermon coming up this week. You know, just keeping it real, y'all. Oh, man, we've got some Jerish life has got me busy. But there are things on the horizon that I would like to get after, and it's really in the space of these kinds of conversations. Regarding the way that the liturgy and mission are related, and that sort of added layer that recently I'm revisiting with this, because that was sort of the focus of my doctoral work. The added layer recently is, learning from voices like Oscar Romero and the ways that he understood that relationship. So there's a lot of like, what does liberation theology, what does the prophetic word have to say? How does that color our understanding of the relationship and of liturgy and mission, and what does that do to us? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I feel like I'm sort of experimenting in my own lab of a parish of learning how to preach, learning how to think and reimagine and make decisions as a rector that believe that conflict is not bad, but that, again, descending into those particulars, prioritizing truth-telling over accommodation and just sort of a fake piece. I feel like I'm experimenting. I think I'm onto something here, and I'm learning how to talk about it. You know, just I'm a little late to the game, but I got some great saints ahead of me who are leading the way.
Yeah,
it's good.
I would love to write on that someday, though.
So I know 60 more seconds. You said something about what Oscar Romero used to do in the middle of his sermons. That sounded very much like akin to what Mennonites do after their sermons. Would you just?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so. Didn't Oscar Romero preach like half a sermon and then do like community announcements and like talk to people?
Yeah. There's like 20 minutes of announcements in the middle of a sermon. And it was always this bizarre to me. I'm like, what is he doing? Like, he's totally like chopping up his argument. And like, why are we talking about pox and this lady's house? They're going to do it's just really random. And then I realized, I think recently I'm reconsidering that what he was actually doing was preaching the gospel and then taking his congregation's attention into those particulars and saying, it looks like this, do this. You guys should go over here and put your bodies here, do these things, get all these opportunities, and then return to the gospel. And for me, you know, I'm looking at that like as a huge interruption. For him, it is one beautiful sermon. I think it takes some time. So is that what Mennonites are doing? Just sort of preaching and then community announcements, but as an outworking of preaching?
More like a discussion, right?
Yeah. Open up for, and we can do it several ways. I sometimes will include the like stop and ask questions in the middle of the sermon and then return to the sermon. A lot of the time, like just this past week, it was really at the end, we have somebody who comes up and says, you know, where did you sense the Holy Spirit today? But not just in the sermon, but in the, and so I reflected on, we had communion. And so I offered the children a blessing because our children are baptized. And so they don't receive. And I always let one of the kids give me a blessing. And this kid like dunked her finger in the oil. Like it was like the beard of Aaron, like the flowing of the oil, like into my eyes. And I was like, but also this sort of like, like her first instinct is like, really like let this oil fly, right? Like really like, why be stingy about this gift? You know, and as we're talking, the sermon was on Romans and grace is like that, right? This is sort of this reflection. And so trying to pull together those pieces and, you know, some other people mentioned the way some of the songs like reflected back what they were hearing from scripture and expounding upon that. And that happens every Sunday in our worship.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that little excursus there, that divergence. Melissa, Sean, absolutely. Thanks for being with us today.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Good to be here, y'all.
Well, I had about 74 more questions, Ben.
Oh, man. I wanted the conversation to go on for another 2 hours.
I was just getting going with that last pro-life question. And then I was going to move on to gun control.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was going to move on to euthanasia.
Yeah.
And then I was going to move on to social welfare.
I thought kids should be able to be, they should be able to exist in Asia. Euthanasia, I don't know why that's, why is that controversial?
Quick Google. Yeah, you should Google that quick.
Yeah. I mean, all that comes up is pictures of young people and they look like they're from Asia. So,
are you sure that you should be on a podcast? all joking aside, I do think the injunction, the admonition I'm taking from both Sean and Melissa in that conversation is, one way to say it is learning how to see who centrism benefits.
Yes.
Who has benefited from staying above it, out of it, away from it, and sort of holding the pristine position that's not tainted or tarnished by, you know, who benefits from that. And I think my move away from centrism has been that seeks to maintain the status quo. And when I read Dr. Martin Luther King's words about white moderacy, if I'm not a white moderate as a centrist, I don't know what I am.
Yeah. 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 It's the same impulse. I think you're right. I think that's what I'm taking away too. And I'm recognizing, I think that was what pulled me out of, I don't know, just general agreement with that kind of way of thinking was, I think realizing that, yeah, that my centrism actually does have an effect on other people. And oftentimes what I was doing in trying to assert these thoughts was nothing more than, I mean, it has the rhetorical effect of, even though these are tricky things because they're true, right? Like as Melissa said, well, sure, it's true that Christianity is neither left nor right. It's a different kind of animal. Sure it is. That's absolutely true. But the rhetorical effect, the effect that has is we get to just pat ourselves on the back for not getting sucked into the ideology. Yeah. And then, you know, and then we don't have to sort of sully ourselves in the secular quagmire. Yeah. It exempts us from embodied involvements in the ways that the gospel actually does need to be worked out in our communities, yeah. which might be showing up at a city council meeting and advocating for a policy, right? That yeah. might be, yes, backed yeah. by one of the political parties, but we're so afraid of being seen as Democrat or Republican. We're so afraid of being seen as partisan that's what that rhetorical effect does. And so I think the conviction for me was, I care more about how people think about me than yeah. I do about the effects of what this does when I assert this.
Yeah.
All it does is something for me.
I think that's when I realized how centrism had done me dirty was when Donald Trump was running for president in 2016. And I felt like I couldn't publicly criticize Donald Trump disavowing and denouncing his misogyny, his, you know, garden variety, Norman Rockwell, white supremacy, his greed, his crimes, his 20 plus sexual assault allegations. I couldn't criticize that without also saying something about Hunter Biden.
Right. You had to be an equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Democrats are bad too.
I felt compelled to be like, and Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky too, which felt like, I don't know. It felt like it blunted the denouncement, and it did. And it was like, why am I feeling compelled to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel compelled to do that for other things.
Yeah.
You know, and I realized it was this, you know, for me, it was this deep belief that the worst thing possible was to be seen as a progressive. Right. Worst thing possible. Worse than being MAGA, worse than being apolitical, worse than being centrist, right, was to be that. And if I didn't criticize, you know, Hunter Biden, you know, Al Franken, if I didn't criticize one of these cats, then I was, well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, so there's a degree of self-reflection, I think, that's necessary for us, right, to like, why is this attractive to me? Because, and there does have to be, I think, for us to actually embrace a Christianity that is neither right nor left, right? We have to abandon the idea that we're going to be seen as people that are neither right nor left. Like in some ways is what I'm thinking here, that we have to have this letting the chips fall where they may mentality, and let people think what they think about us. And we're going to make our, you know, Christian commitments. We're going to make Christian commitments of solidarity. And then we're just going to let the chips fall. Like, okay, you're going to label me a progressive. You're going to say I'm woke. You're going to say whatever.
Yeah,
I just have to let that be because this is what faith demands. So,
yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Hey guys, sorry. Found
Well, Sean, the link. Are you still here?
No, I found the link that you sent.
Yeah.
I just wanted to jump back in real quick. Are you guys busy?
We're just recording an outro. Here.
Didn't know you were still here, Sean.
Oh, my bad. We'll edit this out. Whatever. I felt like I wore my jersey the entire interview and no one, we didn't get to that. So I just wanted to give an opportunity to just take a look.
Take a look.
At this new Austin FC jersey.
Yeah.
The greatest team of all time.
We'll have to describe it for the listeners. Yeah.
Well, just imagine pure beauty. The beatific vision of MLS jerseys is what I am wearing.
Oh, my gosh.
And this Saturday, I also want to tell you, I know it's amazing. This Saturday, my wife and I, Michelle, we're going to go to the game, and I need you to really pray for us because we had a rough start, but we're going to go all the way. Okay, hasta la muerte is what we say.
Okay, I'm more of a centrist when it comes to my how my faith affects my MLS.
No, this you pick a side.
I'm not a partisan. Okay? No, I'm not a partisan when it comes to the MLS. I'm a Christian centrist.
This is life and death, Ben. This is life and death.
No.
Anyways, good to see you.
All right, Sean.
You could say something.
Don't surprise us like that again. How did you get in here?
Sean,
the link. You guys have the link.
Oh. Before you go, Sean.
Oh, here we go.
I have a question for you. And it's I don't think Ben can get it because it takes a knowledge of culture and geography.
Hey, what are you saying?
What is the difference between the people in Dubai and the people in Abu Dhabi?
Ben shaking his head to a dad joke like this is signaling. I don't know. What is it, Matt?
The people in Dubai don't like the Flintstones, but the people in Abu Dhabi do.
No. Saw that coming.
Yeah. You felt it. You felt it.
That'll teach you coming back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let that be a lesson to you.
Just sick Matt's dad jokes on you. All right, listeners, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful or enjoyable, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can join our Gravity community online for free at gravityleadership.com/join.
You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as our email most Fridays with curated links to articles we find interesting and helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the show. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the start recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.